aware that Rick Baker's on set that day. I'm aware that the actor's on the call sheet. I'm aware. But there was a small moment where I was like, is she real? is this the moment? And I remember she slowly, because, you know, she has all the makeup on and stuff, walks all the way up to me and she goes, I think I left my phone in the trailer. And I was like, ruined, ruined forever.
Horror Movie Survival Guide is a weekly podcast where I, Gorehound Julia Marchesi, delves into my horror movie notebook to corrupt another one of my longtime chums, Terry Gamble, who is hiding in the creepy horror closet.
My mission is to learn the gospel of horror movie survival and to incorporate Julia's wealth of wisdom to become a final girl disciple.
Join us as we take a deep dive into everything from OG horror
to newly released films,
but prefer the classics on VHS.
We'll talk about obscure details that no one else notices,
spin off into alternate casting universes, crush on some dodgy, foxy fellows,
and creepy uncles, and arm ourselves with the knowledge necessary to become the final girl.
Hey there, Disco Citizens. Welcome to Horror Movie Survival Guide. Terry, we have a special guest with us today.
Oh my God, Julia, I'm so excited. You have one of your old friends along, and this is like a dream come true. Film is great. I cannot wait to talk about everything. Let's get into it. Can you please introduce our guest this week for Horror Movie Survival Guide?
Yes, I can. Let's talk about Molly Elfman, who is a filmmaker and producer who focuses on innovative ideas and supporting female auteurs. Huzzah. Molly has produced dozens of movies for the company Fun Size Horror, which she co-founded, and she produced the dark anthology Do Not Disturb, Mike Flanagan's film Before I Wake, and Karen Gillan's The Party Just Beginning. So Molly has directed many shorts and episodes, but Next Exit, which are we are talking about today, signals her feature film directorial debut, and it premiered at the 2022 Tribeca Film Festival, where it was nominated for the Best U.S. Narrative Feature and took home the award for Best Cinematography. Plus, she's just super fucking cool. Hi, Molly.
I love that. It's so cool. It's so weird to be introed. I'm like, oh, look, I did shit.
Yes, you did. Hell yeah.
Thank you.
Like when a you us.
When you string it all together like that, and you go, oh, yeah, hey, man, I've done some things. You certainly have.
Yeah.
If you're ever feeling down, play that intro and just have a moment and just like bask for a second, you know? Enjoy your wins.
So we I have done things. Great. Thank God.
We were just talking before we started recording about something about, so we met at the New Beverly Cinema where I used to work. Mm-hmm. And we screened a movie there. What movie did we screen there?
Do Not Disturb, my first film ever.
Wow. So how did that feel? Do you remember that?
Oh God. You know, everything about Do Not Disturb. It's so funny because, you know, that film is still on streaming through Gravitas. It is like 10 years later, I still get checks for like $40 a year.
That's awesome.
And it's like longest running film I will probably ever have on streaming that for some reason keeps going. You know, it's always terrifying. It never gets less terrifying. I've done, I think, a few dozen screenings now and intros for Next Exit. It's still terrifying. I don't know that that'll ever go away for me. But
what is it? What is terrifying about it to you?
People.
Are you afraid? Because I get afraid of like, I'm going to be in a Q&A and someone's going to ask me the like real tough question and put me in a spot. Like that makes me nervous. Do you think about that?
No, I actually love that. I'm like, bring it on. Back in Do Not Disturb days, I will say it was my first time. What I did for that one was it was an anthology, but I created the rules that we all had to play by. So let's see if I think there were 7 rules. I'm trying to remember.
Ooh.
There had to be a prop that one person used and that you would leave for the next person. There had to be, you had to incorporate the maid into your story. So there was all these rules that I gave everybody for all of their stories and really worked on making sure that they were very much tied together. And this was, you know, before the VHS series, before anthologies kind of took off. This was a little bit earlier and it was a way of making films for so much less money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we made it for $30,000, shot it in 7 days, and it was a feature. It's not perfect. And but neither is anybody's first film. So, you know, it was weird because I was kind of a part of writing it. I wrote the wraparound section and I worked with a bunch of different directors. And then oddly, they were also busy and we weren't paying any of them. So I had to take over in post, which was a really wonderful experience, as it would turn out to be. I didn't expect that. But it did allow me to really take a production through editing, through sound, through score, through delivery, which I had never done before. So that was kind of my film school. And then being able to show it at the New Bev was a huge day for me. And the thing is when you're making something like this, you're just thinking about making it. And all of a sudden it becomes a reality of it's something that people are going to watch.
Yeah.
And
so cool.
That's always terrifying. It's something that I think about more now while I'm making it, but you can't think about it too much because you can't try to please everybody because then you'll make a shit show.
Right.
So, you know, but you never really know, like, does it work? I think it's going to work. Does it?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that, you know, Terry and I agree on is that the thing that we love about movies are movies where you can tell it's that person. It's so like a Wes Anderson movie, right? You're like, that's Wes Anderson. And like every Wes Anderson movie, he gets more and more Wes Anderson. And I like that because I'm like, I want to hear your voice. I want to see the world through your eyes. And I think that that's what's most important. So if the film can be the most you it can be, then that's the best.
Yeah. And I mean, there's different sides of who you are, right? And
yes, absolutely.
And you get to keep finding that and you change. That's the directors that I really look up to are the ones that keep changing and evolving and doing something different because there are different sides of us and different experiences. And as we grow, you know, we don't stay the same. And of course, Wes Anderson has a very clear aesthetic and, you know, Tim Burton and all these others. But the ones that are exciting to me are the ones that continue to find new ways of expressing where they are in their lives.
Yeah. So, okay. So we've talked about you and I met. We're starting there. We're going to rewind all the way back.
I want to go
the beginning.
Back.
Cast your mind back to when you started to really love film and horror, where that came along as well.
You know, I actually wasn't trying to become a filmmaker, oddly enough. I was a horseback rider.
Were you really?
Wow. Yeah, I was like a competitive horseback rider by the time I was 9 years old, and I was doing all the shows every single weekend. And by the time I was like 15, was like at my peak. And so by the time I was 18, I was actually training people. And I thought that was my life. I love horseback riding. Movies have always been in the background. I love movies. And actually one of my big inspirations, let's go back even further. My first movie credit, just so everybody's aware, is actually professional stunt pony rider in Black Beauty.
What?
Directed by Caroline Thompson.
Written and directed
by Caroline Thompson. Yeah. And she's always been one of my idols because she was a writing writer. She used to write these amazing films that were so personal and so intricate, sometimes horror and sometimes not. And just so unique. And she was also a horseback rider. So I always wanted to, you know, I went to college for literature and I was riding horses. So that was my dream, right? So while I was at UCLA, I was riding and training. And one of my students was Missy Stabile, who used to be one of the headline producers over at Universal. And she said, "You'd make a good producer." And I'm like, that's a lot of work. I was right. But I started working with her. So I became a line producer, or I became she was a line producer. I became her assistant. And then I became a production assistant on The Ring 2, which was my first major.
Oh, what?
Which I was very excited because I had loved The Ring in high school. I was definitely that person who was, you know, going to Rocky Horror, who was going to opening night, who watched, also because films actually stayed in the theaters. So you saw The Ring 5 times, right? Because that's what you did. You went to the movie theater on the weekends and you watched what was there. And if you'd seen it, you watched it again and again and again and again. So, you know, The Ring had been one of my favorites, and I'll never forget being a PA because we shot Samara towards the end, right? The main ghost that climbs out of the TV in the well. Hopefully everybody's seen it at that point, not too many spoilers. If you haven't, what are you doing? I'll never forget because it was also Rick Baker, who obviously one of the greatest of all times for special effects makeup. Yes. And I was standing on set, I was locking down some location somewhere, and down a long hallway, I see her walking towards me. And I'm aware that Rick Baker's on set that day. I'm aware that the actor's on the call sheet. I'm aware. But there was a small moment where I was like, is she real? is this the moment? And I remember she slowly, because, you know, she has all the makeup on and stuff, walks all the way up to me and she goes, I think I left my phone in the trailer. And I was like, ruined, ruined forever. Oh, God. I was so upset. But I remember I actually met Arjen Tuten, who was Rick Baker's assistant at the time and has since worked with him on projects, including Peopling, most recently a short film that I did. And he kind of took over and is one of, he's now won several Oscars. Like, he's just one of the best in special effects. And I actually met him on that set.
Nice.
For the first time. So, you know, that was kind of my way in. Then I got the bug. I loved film production. I love the chaos of it. I love that so much is going on, but we're all pointed in one direction with one goal, and we can accomplish that. And that really made sense to me in my life. And honestly, horseback riding at that time, I also managed to get a horrible neck injury. And so I was taken out for 2 months. And like, I was like, what am I doing with my life? I love that I thought that film production would be easier on my body. And so then I started getting into filmmaking, and I actually went to school for Meisner Technique and learned how to become an actor, got through 2 years of that while I was still in college. And then realized that's when I wrote Do Not Disturb, was for me to star in, and got that all going. And then the second it came time to shoot it, I was like, I don't want to star in it anymore.
Which no, is why?
Why I'm a horrible actor. I didn't want to. I was like, what am I doing? But that's why I'm not meant to be an actor. I was like, I don't really like being seen. So I do have a role in it that was very fun. And I did end up having a series of roles, spoiler alert, where I was a serial killer. So I also played the lover.
Nice.
Also in Blood of Love. Like, I got kind of like typecast, but I loved it. So very happy getting covered in blood. Loved it. All the different like femme fatales that I got to play was very fun.
See, this is why we're friends, Molly. Because we're like, yes, covered in blood, please. We love it.
More blood.
Sisters. Blood sisters.
Yeah. And then, Do Not Disturb. I took it to a film festival. I saw this film, Absentia. I saw Katie Parker, who I would come to work with later. And I was like, she's fantastic.
We've done an episode on Absentia. She's fantastic. And we love Mike Flanagan like hardcore. So, hell yes.
Yeah. And he saw Do Not Disturb. And so we started to work together. And that was Before I Wake and all the rest of it. In terms of why I got into genre and horror specifically, I still think, and especially with Next Exit, it is not a horror film, but it is kind of made by a horror film lover. Mm-hmm. I think there's those little seeds throughout. But for me, it's always about the character study. Like Poltergeist is one of my favorite, Rosemary's Baby, mm-hmm. like Babadook, A Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night. Like these films are character studies. And the thing is, and it lets you go so much deeper and be so much more introspective, but without making it melodramatic. And that's the thing of what I love about horror. And I think, I've been trying to figure this out because everybody's like, why do you love horror? And I'm like, I guess I got to go talk to my psychologist about this or something like that. Like, I got to get in there. But recently I was thinking about it, and I grew up in a house that had shrunken heads and skeletons and all of that type of stuff around. None of that was ever scary to me. It was never even perceived as darkness or macabre or anything like that. It just was, you know, Uncle Billy on the shelf. And I think when you're raised like that, it's not so much scary. It's kind of part of who you are. But I think my dad did this one very clever thing. So there was this living room filled with all the stuff that he liked to show off, right? Bones and skeletons and this and that. And there was this one little skeleton that would sit above the doorway. And he was just a painted skeleton, just a little fake skeleton. And my dad used to tell me that none of the other skeletons would play with him because he wasn't a real skeleton. He wasn't scary. So every time I passed by him, I had to scream so that the other skeletons would think that he was scary and then they would play with him.
Oh. And
I think that's kind of like the filmmaking that you see today, which is like, I just want the skeletons to have friends.
That is the sweetest story.
So, you know, I think there's a little bit of me I believe in ghosts. I've had ghost experiences. I'm not afraid of ghosts. Ghosts, I think, are something that we need and are something that are trapped here. I don't believe that they are here to hurt us. There are certain other entities that we can talk about, but for me, that's always just been a part of me. So I think when I went to make this film, I didn't want to make a traditional ghost story because ghosts, that's not my truth. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, And then I love a good campy horror film too. I mean, who doesn't?
I mean, yeah. I mean, this is what we're here for. But we have to backtrack to these ghost experiences. You can't just gloss over that. Tell us about that, because it's something we all have questions about, right?
You know, it's funny. I'm just digging into the past, because me, my mom, and my sister lived in a notoriously kind of haunted house growing up, where a woman had been murdered. And several families had moved in and moved out. And we all had experiences, but none of us talked about them till after we moved out. Which I think is also, it's actually funny, because this is part of what I'm writing next, about why we don't always talk about our fear and where fear comes from, and how we redefine it. But I do remember being told, I went to school one day and I just moved into town type of thing. And I told somebody where I lived and they said, "Oh, you live in the murder house." And I went home to my mom, 7 years old. And I was like, "Ah!" And she said, "Don't worry. There was a woman who was murdered here." It was because it was just me, my mom, my sister. She goes, "She's a single woman. We're all single women. She'll take care of us. Don't worry. She'll never hurt you."
Nice spin, wow. Mom. She spun that nicely.
Yeah. And so, you know, there was an experience. There was footsteps down the hall. There was lights that would flicker. There was an experience with shattered glass and that spooked all of us. But the fact of the matter is I never found her scary. I never thought of it like that. She was just a part of the house. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of other stuff. I don't know how much to get into this story at this time, because I could go on for probably another 30 minutes on this. But it was a matter of, again, the different perceptions of how we view things that we're afraid of. And that is something that I am so intrigued by. And I think that can be ghosts, that can be politics, that can be medicine, that can be so many different things. And I'm just so sick of people taking sides on stuff. And it's hard for me not to get stuck on my own sides, but I just want to have a conversation of, we're all just terrified. Let's fucking talk to each other.
Yeah.
That's
wonderful. I think that that's something that horror does, right? It allows you to face fears in a very safe environment that you can then talk to your friends about if it's something that does particularly scare you, right? This is something that I think horror does very well. When you were watching horror films as a kid, can you remember the first one you saw, or the one that really terrified you?
The first film that I saw that I remember very clearly was Poltergeist.
That's going hard.
Yep. Yeah, and I still have a photo of it, because I think it like scarred me so much. But I remember being intrigued by it and wanting to watch it over and over again. The film that I actually watched when I was even younger, it was Jaws, actually. Now I'm remembering. Jaws was the first quote-unquote horror film that I watched. And I used to watch it on repeat over and over again. My mom was so sick of it. And every single time that it would jump out at the end, I would yell, "Big fishy!" I was like a little kid, because I loved it when the big fishy came out of the water.
That's so Bruce.
That was me. But Poltergeist was like a little bit older, and I could actually retain some of it. Or at least I thought I could. I was probably like only 7 or 8. Going back, I do remember the humor of it, like the whole chair scene when she's trying to show him what's going on, mm-hmm. and it not being portrayed as scary. I always loved that. And I always loved the idea of ways that we can communicate with the other side. So I think I've definitely been obsessed with that since very young. And I remember, the film that I haven't gone back to watch is the TV version of It, because I actually, when I was a kid, I watched it. And it terrified me so much. And I know that it's campy. And if I go back and watch it, I'll see all the camp. But I love the memory of it so much in my mind. I like refuse to go back and watch it, because I just want it to be as scary as it was in my 8-year-old brain.
I love that. Because it is like a heartwarming thing to be like, that's the scariest movie I've ever seen. I don't need to see it again. It's done.
Yeah.
But also, as hardcore film horror nerds as we are, finding a horror movie that can terrify you now is rare.
It's a huge feat. Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I get scared all the time. This is the thing. I'm not a brave person. I just love being scared. So like, I just went and saw Barbarian. I was jumping all over the theater. I had so much fun. I go to a horror, I love all the haunts. I love going to stuff like that. I've done like some of the most extreme versions of that. Again, I'm terrified the whole time.
What's the most extreme? I was like, whoa.
I did Blackout. Blackout was probably Blackout. They don't do it anymore.
Okay, what is it?
Down. You guys don't know Blackout?
No.
Please.
Do you guys know horror immersive? Do you do like The Willows or Delusion or any of that type of stuff?
What's horror immersive? Now this is what we've needed. What? Tell us.
You got to get out there. You got to get into some of these hunts. You got to get horror to jump out on your face.
Okay.
Immersive horror experiences. That's something that I've gotten into the past 6 years now. Shit, that happened for a while. And they're basically stories that you get to go and you're a part of the horror film, whatever it is. And it's a blast. And some of them are more like Delusion, which I just did, which is more of a walkthrough with stories. Mm-hmm. And they kind of, you know, you're running through graves and people are chasing you and there's, you know, monsters that appear. I got locked in a cupboard at some point, but engaged.
Are these like on location someplace or like where are you finding these ones?
Yeah. Running through a house. These are some of the mainstream ones. I can send you a list of,
off the grid ones though, is what I'm hearing.
These are all the main ones that I'm telling you about. The Willows, great experience. They always do a very good job. Creep does a great experience.
So what was Blackout?
Blackout was one that was one of the more, like, you get slammed against a wall, put in a trash bag, you know, dragged around and stuff.
Wow.
That was a little bit more. There was a wave of those. I think too many people have gotten hurt at this point, so I think a lot of them have mainly shut down, and for good reason.
That sounds terrifying.
It's fun. Yeah. It's fun. Theater Mom. The tension experience was a big one.
Yeah, I'm happy we did a fun one. We went to visit Peaches Christ in San Francisco and went to the Summoning, and I think that was probably the scariest haunted house experience I've gone through, and it was great. And I'll stick with that maybe. I don't know if I would want to be thrown in a trash bag.
But it is quote unquote still safe, right? You are something that you're inside the horror movie even further than, you know, than you already are.
Yeah. I did 3 years of this, by the way, at the Overlook Film Festival, and it was very fun to mess with people. I can send you some links if you want to put some stuff up with it, but to literally immerse people in a horror film.
Oh, this is great. And I haven't been to the Overlook Film Festival yet, but this sounds like it's fantastic. Let's move forward from where we were. We went from Do Not Disturb. We met Mike Flanagan. Let's get into Karen Gillan. How did you meet Karen?
I met Karen on the set of Oculus.
That's Julia's favorite movie.
What's her top five? It's in her top five.
It's so good.
If you look, I'm an extra in the top of that scene when they're bidding the mirror. I'm in that scene. So I met Karen that day because we were putting together a film that with Mike that didn't end up happening and then made Before I Wake instead. So I was actually in Alabama prepping that film and then it didn't go. But I did meet Karen that day in the van, and I was just like, who is this crazy woman? And she was lovely, and we became friends. And then the party's just beginning. She had sent it to Mike asking for notes, and he said, I'll give you notes, but I can't help you with this, but Molly can. So I read the script, and then I worked with her, and we did two short films. We did Coward, and then we did Conventional. Conventional is still one that has gotten turned into Axe Wound, which will hopefully be a feature film that we get to make one day.
Yes.
It's so good. It's just, I need Karen's schedule to open up for long enough time for her to direct again, which is a challenge. She's a popular one, that Gillan.
She
these
is.
Days.
I know she's working on a new series and some other stuff and some animated stuff, so yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, but we did The Party's Just Beginning. And for me, again, I wanted to make a horror film at that point, but I read that film and it wasn't my story. I'm not from Inverness. That wasn't an exact interpretation, but for some reason I knew that story. I knew that person. It felt so personal and so important to me. So we worked on that script, and I just remember reading the script and I said, well, who's your director? And she said, me. And I was like, have you ever directed? And she's like, no, because Karen's like the most enthusiastic person about anything. And I was like, okay, well, let's have you direct. And she was like, great. And so we did her first film, Coward, which had Rose McIver starred in it, and James Ransom was in it. They were wonderful. And then we did Conventional, which is one of my favorite shorts that I think I've ever made. And then we went
out. What was the most fun about it? What did you love about it? What makes it your fave?
It is just the raw truth of that one, also mixed with horror. It is exactly what I love making, which is something that is so truthful and so honest and so character driven, and then so dark and twisted. There's a certain humor to it that I really resonate with. Again, a little bit of humor, I think, allows you to take on the deep messages of a film or of a project. So it just kind of nailed that one for me. And I personally, I think Karen has such an interesting, bold voice. So it was really fun for me to support her in that.
Awesome.
And that's so neat for you to go from, you know, going from producer to writer to filmmaker. I mean, this is a big jump. And I know, you know, producing is hard. Very hard. Probably most people who aren't into filmmaking world like we are don't know how hard it is, but we know. And then to take on extra roles as well. Tell us about that journey and how it's all been going for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was also 6 years of being a film journalist in there that was crossing over with all of that simultaneously, which I think was very informative for me, because seeing all the movies, reviewing, talking to writers and directors, going to Sundance, Tribeca, you know, all these film festivals, I think was very informative for what would happen later. And having that knowledge, I was very grateful for.
How did that come about? Sorry, let's skip back to that then.
Yeah, I know. This is the thing. It is not a straight line.
Good.
It all overlaps.
All over the fucking place, man.
it all overlaps. How did I get into that, or how did I?
Honestly,
it was me getting out of college and needing a job was the first one. I worked for an LA magazine to begin with, and then I started covering movies for them, and then I found the Screen Crave Network, and then I started covering new movies for them, and then I became an editor, and then I became the editor-in-chief for a while and kind of took over for that, which is, I think, kind of goes to show why I am kind of a producer or director type. Is I tend to be very good at gathering people and getting work done and organizing that. That was always kind of my main skill. So it started as just a gig that I could do while I was going to acting school, riding horses and producing whatever I could to make some money.
Corralling people. I'm seeing the through line now, you know?
Exactly. I herding cats is what I do for a living, one way or another.
How did the Fun Size Horror stuff come about?
That was because, so Mike and I, like I said, we were supposed to make that other film that ended up not happening. That was the one that I had also, Katie Parker had read for, and that's also the first time that I got to work with her as an actress. Mm-hmm. And that one ended up not happening because Trevor Macy, who had just worked with him on Oculus, who wanted to keep working with Mike, said, what if we made this other one that I also had the rights to, Before I Wake? And we said, sure. So we moved into that one, and we went and we made that film, which was supposed to be like the first time that I made a bigger budget film, full release, all the rest of it. Relativity had picked it up. Everything was going great. And then 2 weeks before the release, they filed for bankruptcy, and we couldn't get a person on the phone. It was horrible. And we found Lionsgate was going to come in and release it. And then immediately they did get on the phone with, they were going to sue us. So it took 2 years. I had also had a TV show going with them at the time. It took 2 years to get that out of legal chaos.
Oh my goodness. That's the fun part of filmmaking, right?
Yep.
When you think you finally made it, this is the moment, something shits on it.
We don't know anything about that.
No, I mean, I think that to me is the most terrifying thing about making a film, is it really can fall apart at any stage.
At any stage. And even at the end, even when it's completely done, with the trailers done, the posters done, there's posters around town, there's billboards of this thing, it can still fall apart. Yep. I think the scariest part for me was the fact that when I told people about this, nobody was surprised. Everybody's like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, I've done that. And it was like, so this is just another one of those learning experiences on the way. So while that was crumbling and my life was crumbling in front of me, and the next project that I had was with them, and so I didn't have rent and all the rest of it, I had Zeke Pinero and Mikey May come up to me and say, we want to make 31 short horror films for Halloween. And it was May. And I was like, yeah, I need something to do. So I just jumped into that. And then after we accomplished that, we were like, well, we should actually keep going with this. And so we did. And that's where I got to work with so many new voices that I've continued to work with, be it Rose McIver, be it Karen Gillan, Lucas Amen, just so many amazing, different, interesting creative voices, and give them kind of a chance of making a short film that could help start their careers. Because mm-hmm. it's just so hard to get people, if you're a first-time writer director, to get somebody to look at your work, to read your script, to do any of that. So I, you know, having a short film that kind of shows off what you can do and stands apart is actually, I think, a very important part of that. So it was really fun to be a part of that. And I learned so much taking, I mean, I produced over 40 shorts in that
time. Look at that. That is amazing, Molly, because you're learning, sure, but you're also giving a hand up of paying it forward to so many other people. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. And it also, by the way, that's why when I went to finally direct, I knew exactly who I wanted. Like, I've worked with so many crews. I had my post team on lock. Like, you do establish the relationships, because the whole thing about filmmaking is who are your people? Who is your tribe that you're going to go to, that yeah. you're going to feel safe with, and are going to take care of you, and you can take care of them. And so by the time I got there, I had those people. We trusted mm-hmm. one another. We had done, you know, several shorts together, and we knew how to speak to one another, good communication. So no, I love short films, and I love doing a lot of them. I think it was a great experience for me. And I, you know, we are kind of sadly shutting down Fun Size Horror mm-hmm. Just because it's a lot of work. And during the pandemic, it was too hard for us to maintain, and we just haven't been able to quite get it back. Yeah. I'm very grateful for that time and that experience that we all had together.
And as you mentioned, it led directly to this film, right? To having this yeah. crew set that you wanted to work with. So shall we segue?
Yeah, next exit.
Let's go. Beginnings.
We're taking Huzzah. The next exit. Yes, to the next exit. Ah. I love this. So tell us, like, I guess the genesis for this project and how you got to next exit.
Well, in the background of all that we just spoke about, I was always working on this. It was, you know, 10 years of me dabbling, writing poetry. This was the script that whenever I was in a bad place mentally, whenever I was going through something, whenever I had a loss, I went back to the script. It was my hope. It was my way through. It was one that I knew that anybody would make, because it wasn't the easy sell. It's not the easy pitch. And because whoever it was going to have to rely on, I could handle multiple genres, which often doesn't work, and handle a tone that was incredibly difficult. And it would rely on two actors delivering two fucking hell of performances.
Powerhouse.
Yeah, like they're both yeah. going to have to show up on that level. And so, you know, a lot of people didn't want to give me money for this for a very long time. And the conceit was one that, honestly, the second that COVID hit, became much easier for me to pitch, because before it was, you know, something happened and watch the ripple effect, and everybody's like, that's not what happens. And then COVID hit and they were like, oh no, that is what happened. So a lot of people think I wrote this because of COVID or in response to COVID. I didn't. It's not like my COVID film, although we did shoot it during COVID. It was just a film that I think people finally resonated with because they finally understood it.
Yeah, people talking in rooms. Also, I was like, oh my gosh, Julia's favorite things. This is yes, amazing.
My passion are character-driven films, and the less people, the better for me. Mm. So My Dinner with Andre is one of my favorite. What Happened Was, yeah. these movies where, you know, two, three people, I'm like, that's all I need, because I'm interested in seeing the world through somebody else's eyes. And that's the thing, that this was such a fantastic movie to see these characters develop and in a very natural way.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I mean, that's good. I'm glad. yeah, no, for me, it's always been these two characters. This was always me working through stuff. It was always, a lot of this was me writing their backstories, their monologues that they never had, conversations they never had. That's where I started. With so many scenes that are not in the movie. And then eventually that's kind of figuring out the structure. To think about. Yeah.
That's great. I'm sorry. Please continue.
No, sorry. I mean, that's basically it. It was knowing these characters inside and out. And then all that you do is you create the structure and you throw them into it and you see what they do. But when you know them that well, it's more like they take off into this movie and you got to keep your fingers writing and then start trimming it all down, because there's way too much on the page, which was always my problem.
Yeah. How much would you, with the original first draft, how long would you say it was?
You know, I don't know, because a lot of the stuff never even made it into the draft. The thing that I have is like tons of side folders of like Rose's monologue, Rose's conversation here, like wrote, like they never even made it into the script. I have conversations that Rose had that are poetry that Rose wrote. Like I wrote stuff from her perspective. Wow. And the thing that I would find are like the little gems in there. So like you highlight a couple of those lines and then you're like, this is where I'm going to use that. This is where I'm going to use that. And you find that. So a lot of it was never even in the script. I'm sure, I have no idea how long the first draft was. By the time that I started putting it in, I was more organized. That's kind of the way that I work. It's all this side notes, Google Docs. And I don't know how long my Google Docs are. They're very long. you know, like that type of stuff. And then eventually I put it in. It was probably like 125 pages, something like that, I'd guess. And then you just whittle it down. But I always knew that it was a road trip. I always knew that I wanted to, the conceit with Rio in the beginning was something that I added later, because I used to have a lot more explanation of the world and I really just didn't care about it. And I didn't want people to be focusing too much on it in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about the little Rio sequence is I could kind of give you the thesis of the movie and an idea of the tone of the movie and then take off and just to, it was almost like an aperitif, which I mm-hmm. really enjoy. I found
that really interesting, because you have this, you know, I'm sure you can describe it and I can, the kind of idea of the world, but you have this world and where something unusual is happening and everybody, the society is changing towards it. Mm-hmm. But you're kind of shifting, the movie doesn't focus on that, right? The movie is about these two people and living in this world and not the world that it's created. Yeah. But the supernatural is involved. If you can just talk about how that came about.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly it, because, you know, I'll just take COVID for an example. When COVID was happening, I wasn't focused on how COVID worked, what the DNA or, you know, what it was doing. I was focused on, is my family okay? Mm-hmm. Do I have food? What are the, you know, it becomes a much more personal experience. And so this world changes, and then it's very much about these personal experiences and two people who are trapped by something and are haunted by something in two different ways. And so for me, it was always about these characters, and it was always about what haunts them and what have they not been able to say because they've been treating life a certain way, and what can this other person give them that will actually allow them to finally say their truth and then finally make a choice. And again, it's not so much about giving an answer. It was about seeing them finally make a choice for themselves and also finally give to another person, because I think both of them were trapped in their own issues, own brains. That's definitely something that I've experienced, and both of them needed to do something for somebody else. And I think that they really experience that as they start to open their eyes to the rest of the world around them.
The way that that's married with the supernatural in this story.
Yes. And the supernatural for me, what a ghost is what haunts you. You know, I intentionally, the company, I don't know if anybody notices, called No Traffic for Ghosts. And it's because I don't think everybody dies and is just chilling on the other side. It would be way too busy. Although, you know, karma answers that for us. There's billions of stars. Who says that time is the same on the other side? By the way, don't believe it is. Time right. is something that we constructed for us in order to live our lives.
Yes.
But ghosts do not care about time. And so there is that, but also we create our own voids. We create our own, whatever you want to call it, next stage afterlife for ourselves. So when Rose gets to experience that, I think it's very much about her creation, what she's not able to let go. And it was very important to me that the ghosts not be, while they're in our realm, are a lack of light and a darkness that we don't understand. And once on the other side, that they actually would be something different and would be something light and would be something that if you just looked at it a different way, maybe it was something that you needed. And if you can come to peace with that, maybe you can make some better choices. Hopefully.
I just felt like ghosts were a metaphor for perspective is what I felt in this film. So it's like, okay, yeah. It's just a different perspective, different viewpoint. And yeah, they were very illuminating, right? So I love how beautiful they were too.
And yeah. When it came to a point where you realized that there was a point in the script where you have to visually show what the afterlife could possibly be like, mm-hmm. How did you grip that in your brain and think about how you wanted to portray that?
It was just what came into my head. I wish I had like I didn't pull from anything or anything like that. Like for me, I've always imagined it to be like nature. I've always imagined, you know, when you see the reflections in when she is on the other side, they're not moving at the same time. I would always imagine that it would be something similar, but different. I imagine if she stayed there long enough that also shapes would no longer, the human form would no longer become relevant. But that was for me, that was just always the way that I saw it. I will say that there was, you know, there's some fun little gags that we do. And if I would have gotten my way, there was probably like five more of those that got really fun and really dark and twisted. But, you know, time, money, shooting schedule, all the rest of that. But I don't know. That was the first thing that came to my mind and really the only way that I could ever envision it.
So is it something that you think that people can choose to stay and be like, I don't like, because obviously you don't know the answer to this, but let's hypothesize all ghosts. Yeah. So let's say the woman who was in your house haunted, right? When you grew up, she's just there, but she's not like poltergeist where she can like follow you, right? It's just like in that house.
Well, poltergeist is something different. And you know, that was one of the fun things that if I would have been able to do, she would have been going through doors and there would have been doors to different moments and she wouldn't have been able to leave those doors because what it is unfinished business, right? Okay, it is the things that you can't get away from. And if time and space doesn't exist and you can just go from one room to another very, very quickly, I think that's probably what's going on. Now, there is, by the way, a full lore, so I could break that all down. I try not to give too many specifics because I have found people interpret it differently and I love that because it is about your interpretation of that whole piece. But I will say for me, for ghosts, I don't think that they are attached to something here. So be that a person, be that a place, be that an experience, be that a trauma, there is a reason why they're still there. So the woman in my house, I think, was murdered very, very violently and for no good reason. And I do think that she was sticking around that house to protect it. And she had also made choices for that house. She loved that house a lot. And I think she didn't want those choices to be taken away. You know, we always left the pool tile, which was the argument that she got killed over. We left her rose garden. We left all that type of stuff. And I always thought that it was very important to her and to whatever she was sticking around for. And now maybe she was waiting for him to come back and she could kill him violently. You know, that's a dream for me. But, you know, I think also, you know, her children were in that house for a long time. And I'm sure that if that were the case, I would want to stick around. And that's kind of, that's Rio in the beginning, is like Rio and his dad, is what wouldn't the dad do to stick around and see his son, and especially the son wanting to see his dad.
Yeah, that little line was so sweet when he's on the talk show and they're like, he's like, I just want to see my dad, that's all, you know, just simple, the simplest things.
Ugh,
too just much. I also, can I just chat with you about the billboards along the way?
I love this road trip. So much.
Delightful. We're always looking at, especially at our show here, all the little details, like always listen to the news story in every, you know, movie, like always listen to and like read the things that are in the background. These were so fun to watch along the way. Can you talk about creating those or how you came to those little teehees on those? They're so cute.
Oh, I had so much fun. There's so many more too, that I just, there wasn't good spots for them that I had written into the script. I think my favorite one is the Jesus died for your sins.
Wait, where is he?
Oh, I love that one so much. Why hasn't he come back? Wait, has he? All the different questions that you could ask about Jesus. It was my little thing of like, look, there's a much deeper conversation. I'm not going to get into that was also part of what I'm saying. Like, you guys can have that conversation if you feel like it afterwards, but where Jesus is, I'm not going to get into all of that. It's a little tongue in cheek. The Dr. Stevenson's logo that keeps appearing all around and kind of the infiltration and the marketing that would have gone into all of that, I thought was very fun to play with.
And her Liz Holmes voice, like very Dropout, very, what was it, Theranos vibe that she's giving to as the doctor. Oh,
Yeah. Karen was so much fun. That was so much fun to work with. I wish I could have worked with her more. You know, there was always supposed to be another Dr. Stevenson scene at the end and we had it written and Karen was down to shoot it. We ended up pulling it because everybody at the end just wanted to be with the two leads. Like, they just didn't care about what Karen had to say or Dr. Stevenson at that point, because they were like, what happens to Rose? What is she going to do? Yeah. And so it's funny to have, like, your biggest name in the film who you have come out, and then you're like, actually, we can't use that. Sorry.
That's okay, though. That's all right. I mean, I think
Karen's doing fine.
No, she's fine. And I think that you definitely made the right choice. And it reminded me a little bit of the Children of Men, in that sense of, like, society has come to be okay with people. Like, because in Children of Men, the government sends out suicide kits, right? That's something that they're doing there. And this is something where your choice is now, but then this is something that you're with the assumption of not being just dead, right? That there's something beyond, and that we're coming to a point in society where people would realize that, which I think is probably not too far in the future, question mark?
Yeah. Well, Children of Men, another fucking amazing film that I absolutely love. I also think there's some hope in there, but it's bleak on a level that I don't know that I would have felt the same if it would have been made today. And I do think that there is something to the time of when you release your film and what you need to say. You know, there is a darker version of this film, and again, if I would have made it when I was younger, we would have seen it. But the world today is so fucked on so many different levels. And I'm constantly trying not to have panic attacks. You know, part of me making this film is like looking at the chaos around me and needing there to be some kind of light and wanting to be earnest and wanting to say, let's not turn our backs to it. Let's not ignore it. We have to deal with it. But also saying we have to find some joy and some light, because this is our time on this earth, and we need to be able to figure that out at the same time. And that balance is the one that I have yet to figure out. The tone was much easier than that balance in life.
Well, I hope that you do. I mean, as we mentioned in the beginning, when we did your intro, I hope that you do take time to look back on everything you've accomplished and are still accomplishing, because I think, you know, you do incredible things. And when I watch you from afar on social media, I go, she's amazing. She, like, I just watch you continually, you know, I see you on an upward climb, right? And this is just another step where now you're taking it to film festivals. Now it's going to be released. Talk about how it feels now.
Remember that thing about the people? That's still scary. You know, that actually one of the most heartening experiences that I just had was we did a Southwest Haunted Next Exit tour. And we took the film back to Tucumcari, where we shot a big chunk of it in Albuquerque and Arizona. And it was really nice to screen it for people who weren't film festival people. They don't watch a ton of films. These are not the film goers, which has been my experience, which is nice because you can have these deep intellectual and like, oh, I see you shot it this way and all the rest of it, like, ready to do that. But these were just people who were just watching a movie, and we had these amazing conversations about, there was this couple who came up to me who was much older, who, you know, was talking about losing a friend, and they had wished that assisted suicide had been an option for them. And it was such an important conversation. And they said, we always feel like we're not allowed to talk about this. And we're not allowed to talk about it as in something that we would like to make a choice that makes us happy. And we feel like this film kind of opened that up for us. And I was like, that's fucking huge. Because I'm trying not to say, you know, just, some people may just want to jump to the other side. There's a lot of issues. This life still matters. That's a huge, important thing. But also, death is a reality for all of us. And it's something that I think for most people is very, very scary. And being able to have conversations where we can talk about it is imperative, and is also imperative to getting rid of the shame and the fear and the things that keep us from the quality of life. And also, I think, steer people towards making choices that are maybe wrong for them, because they feel like they have to make a choice, be this about religion or beliefs or whatever, because they need to find an answer. And I think the hardest answer is not always knowing. And so having those conversations and not being afraid of those conversations, I just find to be imperative.
And how fantastic that your film can produce these kind of conversation revelations. That's huge, Molly. That's incredible.
I hope so. But it's been wild. Tribeca was the most terrifying experience, because that's the first time people saw it, right? And then it got then we did more. Fantasia, honestly, was the best experience I've ever had with the film. In fact, it's the last time that I'm going to watch the film. because I had already stopped watching it because all I can see are the mistakes that I made when I see it.
Oh, so
I sat down in that audience and they were hooting and hollering and laughing. And like somebody at one point goes, no. And I was like, okay, it is never going to play better than this room. This was like the most joyous experience of my life. And so I just stopped. It was a great theater, great sound, great everything. So thank you, Fantasia, for giving me my final view of the film. So that was good. And playing LA last night was a very friendly crowd. I love, you know, friends and family.
Where did you play in LA?
We played Brain Dead last night.
Oh, nice. That place is great.
I hadn't been since they reopened it.
I just went to they had a 16mm 12-hour horror marathon I went to a couple weeks ago. So
they play.
Oh, they played. It was a creature feature thing. It was amazing. Really fun. So we have a question that we like to ask all of our guests, mm-hmm. if we may ask you this question. Mm-hmm. You are, like us, quite horror-minded. Mm-hmm. What is a tip you could give someone to survive a horror film?
You're all about survival here, so anything is great.
Don't run away. I always think... at ultimately, what always ends up happening is that everybody's running, and then they face the beast. They face the monster. Of course, you're going to need some weapons, probably. So make sure you got something, whatever it is. You're going to have to figure stuff out. But I do think that it's really important to figure out, because monsters are given their power because we are afraid of them. So figuring out how you're going to face that beast and standing up to it is the most important thing.
That's some of the raddest survival tips we've gotten, Terry.
That was pretty fucking good. About this deeply thought out answer from, no, I am not. After watching your film, this, yes, you are a deep thinker. No, for real. This was a twist and I love it. We've never gotten a tip like that. This is great.
Really?
No. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Everyone's usually like, run, don't split up or whatever. But like, you're like, no, hold your ground, face your beast.
It is because, you know, the whole point of our podcast is how do you survive the horror film, right? How do you become the final girl? And the final girl or boy or family or et cetera, you have to face them alone is always the thing as well, right? Nobody can help you. And so, you know, the sooner you realize that, the better. So you're just saying, just do it right away. So this is good. You cut straight to the chase.
Let's get to it. Ask that ghost why it's there. What you looking for? Hey, ghosty.
What do you need? What do you need?
What's up? What's up?
What you want?
What you want? Yeah. Different things. And again, if it's like a creature feature and it's like Jaws, you might not want to like, maybe that's not the best options.
Fire's usually good to kill pretty much whatever ails you.
Yeah, fire is a good one.
Except for ghosts.
You're not getting very far with them.
No,
because maybe that's why. I'm preempted for ghosts all the time.
Because how do you kill a ghost?
You let it go.
Right. It's always you can't, right? That's always the thing in movies is you can't kill a ghost. You just have to kind of release it in some way.
Yeah. Have it set free or released from its hold.
Or release from its hold. Or also you have to let yourself go from it, because a lot of times it's us that are tying ourselves to it. I truly believe.
Would you say that Poltergeist is your favorite ghost related film?
I think it's got to be The Orphanage. Honestly,
interesting. Ooh. We haven't covered that one. That's a good one.
No, we should.
I remember watching that one and it just breaking me. The emotional core of that one, the storyline, female protagonist, issues with motherhood. I mean, that one just got me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do appreciate, speaking of a female protagonist, that you are very supportive of other ladies, and I would just like to say thank you for that, because it's always helpful for ladies helping ladies.
Underrepresented voices is like a huge piece of it. So it's mainly female horror makers, also non-binary, also just anybody who's outside of the boxes. I love supporting. It's been so important for me as a director, I'm starting to now read scripts coming in. The amount of scripts where people say that it's a female-driven film, and I'm just watching these women get tortured the entire time and then having one moment. That is not what we are trying to do. We have so much more that we can do, and I want to see these women take the real lead. So that's been my main driving force right now, and let's see if I can actually accomplish it. I don't know what's going to happen next.
I believe in you. I believe in you.
Me too. Yeah.
you're facing the fears, right? You're the one who said stand up and ask them and face it. And that's what you're doing in all levels. So I love that. So can you let the people know where they can find you, like on the internet and all that kind of good stuff?
Yeah. I'm just Molly Elfman everywhere. Molly, M-A-L-I, but Twitter, Instagram. You can follow Next Exit Film. That's where I am.
Amazing. And people can stream your film anywhere, everywhere. That's what's happening.
Yeah, it's in select theaters this Friday, and then it's everywhere on demand. So if it's in a theater near you, go and see it, because I always love it being seen on a big screen, but also just see it because it's fun.
Especially for those night sky vistas and like shooting stars and just so pretty. So pretty. Oh,
you're going to watch gorgeous. It at home. Make sure it's a really dark room. Mm-hmm. Just settle down, get off your damn phone and have some fun.
You heard it here, folks. This is how you watch this film. Molly, thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. I'm so happy to see your success, and I am here rooting you on as always.
Yes. Thank you. It's so nice to catch up. And also thank you. You know, a reason why I'm here today is because people believed in Do Not Disturb and what I did with that film. And it is such, that is what makes the difference to starting a filmmaker's career, is somebody taking a risk on them when they are just starting out. So thank you for that, because I still remember that screening and what a big day that was for me. So thank you so much, Julia.
Yay. Oh my God, I love it. And you guys can follow us at Horror Movie Survival Guide all over the internet, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We also have a Patreon if you want to support this all lady led team, our editor and everybody. And you can also get some merch at our Teespring store. Check it out. We'll be back next week with more Horror Movie Survival Guide. Thank you all so much for listening.
Thank you, everyone. And watch Next Exit, please.
Please. Just do it.
Do it.
Face your ghosts. Just do it. Ask them what they want. All
right. Yeah. Bye. Thank you for listening. Horror Movie Survival Guide is independently produced by Terry Gamble, Julia Marchesi, and Sierra Ryan. Hey, that's me. If you would like to support the show, find us on patreon.com/horrormoviesurvivalguide.